The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
What a terrific time the Hayes Advantage has had here the past 2 days, talking to some of the top economists, policymakers in the world, and I have one of them now sitting across from me. He is a Federal Reserve official. His name is Jim Bullard. He's president of the St. Louis Fed. As you may recall, if you're a faithful Hayes Advantage listener, we did our show out there at the Fed Bank not too many months ago. Jim is here, like so many others, to hash out the big picture question, long-term growth issues for the U.S. economy, and I am sure, no doubt, like everybody else, looking at the short-term question of what is going on in the economy and what happens next. Jim, welcome.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we obviously appreciate you taking the time. When it's so gorgeous and you could be hiking or lying by the pool.
I could be hiking. That's right.
Right. At any rate, so Ben Bernanke spoke today, and I'd say the main consensus evaluation is talk to me in September. We're looking, we're waiting, we're not sure what's going to happen. Interesting to me that Alan Meltzer, who is a colleague of yours and Ben Bernanke's, right? But he's been one of Ben's critics, and he's been a critic of QE2, quantitative easing. When I asked him what did he think of the speech, he gave Ben Bernanke an A+. He said because he's realizing you can't expect monetary policy to do everything, and he's pointing to fiscal policy as where you have to get some leverage.
Well, I agree with Alan on that. I mean, certainly monetary policy cannot do everything. We can do our part, but that's only one part of the macroeconomic picture and only one part of the policy mosaic, and certainly fiscal policy is a big part of the policy picture, and that's not our job.
A speech like this, Jim, how should we understand it? Many of the guests I've had on coming up to this day in Jackson Hole when Ben Bernanke would give the speech, yeah, and the markets were waiting, was that the Fed chairman in a speech like this doesn't reflect his own views. He's reflecting the view of the committee. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's always a fair assessment of the chairman. The chairman has to work very hard to stay in the middle of the pack with the committee, and he certainly got opinions of his own, and he tries to persuade people, but on the other hand, he's got to stay in the middle and represent the views of the committee. He does a great job of that, and I think the other thing about a speech like this is that, decisions get made. He can sort of lay out the situation in a speech, but really the decision has to be made at a meeting.
Was there any sense of hastiness at that last meeting when on August 9th, the bold statement to say that the key rate would remain near zero, possibly for 2 years, depending on the strength of the economy? It occurred during a very volatile time in the stock market. There were some really big down days then. Is there a sense now that that was part of what pushed the committee to make that step in spite of three dissenters, and maybe now it needs to be reconsidered a bit?
I don't know about, reconsidering or anything. I suppose we can always review our decisions as we go forward. But I would say it's always hard to have a meeting when there's a lot of market volatility right around the meeting, because there's a lot of preparation that gets done. The staff does a great job of, preparing a forecast and so on. And if the data is really volatile, even in the days and hours, before the meeting, then that sort of raises a lot of questions. People start to say, well, how is that affecting what we think is going to happen? And so it's very difficult to have a meeting in that environment. Now, one thing you can do is you can say, well, let's wait till things settle down a bit. And sometimes that's the reaction. But on the other hand, sometimes markets are really looking toward the committee. So it's a difficult thing to have a meeting right in the middle of a sort of a financial turmoil.
What was your key takeaway from Chairman Bernanke's speech today?
I thought he did a very good job of summarizing our situation and then tying it into some of the issues about longer run growth. I think one of the things he pointed out, which is important, is that many of the policies that are affect long run growth are not really part of the Fed's portfolio. So human capital development or tax policy or trade policy, all these kinds of things are decided elsewhere and not by the Fed.
The Fed has added a second day to its September meeting. is it logical for us to conjecture outside the Federal Reserve that QE3 is not off the table and a longer meeting will give the committee a chance to put more deeper thought into taking that next step?
I think going to September does a couple things for us. It allows us to get more information on how the economy is evolving. As you know, people have been pretty uncertain. A lot of forecasters have started marking down their forecasts for the second half of 2011. You know, is that really what's going to happen, or is it more realistic to think that the second half will be stronger than the first half? So I think we really want to get a little better feel at this juncture on where the economy is headed. And if the economy is weaker and the inflation picture moderates some from where it is, then I think we could consider more action. But if we did consider more action, there's a lot of different options out there. So we really have to think harder about what those options are. Every one of them carries a risk with it. And so you have to get the risk-reward right for each option, think about it, and then make a decision. So there's two aspects, I think. One is to get more information on the economy to see if you need to do anything. And the second part is if you did need to do something, you'd have to decide which direction to go in.
Then it's not necessarily conclusion here that more quantitative easing, a round of QE3, is off the table. In other words, if all tools are considered, that's one of the tools, and it's one that could or will be seriously considered.
Yeah, I've called it our most potent tool, and I think it is our most potent tool. But you know, as we found over the last year, it carries some risks with it, and you know, one of them is maybe QE2 pushed up commodity prices. A lot of our critics have pointed to that, and maybe that's counterproductive, so that's something you have to keep in mind. But I've called it our most potent tool because I think it did ease monetary conditions last fall. I think you'd have to be blind to say, to have been in financial markets during last August, September, October, and say that what the Fed was doing was not influencing anything. I mean, that's a little too much. So it did ease financial conditions. The real effects on the economy would lag by 6 to 12 months, 18 months, you know, long and variable lags for the effects of monetary policy. And in the meantime, other shocks hit the economy. So it's always hard to disentangle the real effects of monetary policy over that kind of a horizon. So that's why, you know, there's always long-running arguments in academia about what are the real effects of monetary policy. I mean, this has happened just in the very recent past. We lowered the funds rate very aggressively in early 2008, you might remember, and that was because we were about 6 months into the financial crisis and very aggressive easing. If you look 6 to 9 months after that, we were in a huge recession. So if you just look at it that way, then you might say, well, that easing didn't do anything for the economy, didn't improve employment, didn't improve production for the economy. Instead, the economy tanked. So, but I don't think that's the way most people think about it. They think that easing of monetary policy did ease financial conditions, and then other shocks hit the economy out 6 or 9 months later. So I think the same thing happened after QE2, where other shocks hit the economy during the spring of 2011, and we'll have to see here whether the economy is able to strike a stronger tone in the second half of 2011 here.
Fair to say QE3 is potentially still on the table when the Fed meets in September?
I would never take anything off the table. You know, I think in monetary policy you have to react to the way the economy is. So yeah, I think it's still on the table. It's an option, but the call is much more difficult this year than it was last year, because this year we have a much different inflation situation than we had last year. I mean, last year we had all measures of inflation below target and declining, and it really looked like you might get into a deflationary situation. I was very concerned about that myself. This year, you know, if you look at something like the CPI measured from a year ago on headline, you know, we're at 3.6%. That's quite a bit of inflation. Now, we do think that'll moderate. I think that'll moderate, but I'd like to see it moderate before I did anything further.
So for you to be in favor of another round of quantitative easing, you're going to be watching the inflation rate. If it stays where it is or moves higher, Jim Bullard would say, respectfully submitted, I'm not going to, I wouldn't say yes, I wouldn't agree to another round of quantitative easing.
Well, it'd certainly be a major factor that I would look at. I mean, I look at everything. I'd look at the economy as well, but it'd certainly be a major factor because we know that taking further easing action is going to increase inflation risk in the economy, so you want to take that very seriously and be very careful about that.
Is it your sense that your fellow FOMC colleagues on the spectrum of whatever you want to call dovish to hawkish, however you want to divide them, but would you say that's kind of a shared sense that everybody figures compared to a year ago, that is one of the big differences, and one of the big differences why taking another quantitative easing step would require something dramatic in the economy, some kind of more dramatic weakness than just saying, well, it's not growing fast enough, let's try some more?
Well, I can't speak for others on the committee. I will say that even if you just, you know, I prefer to look at headline inflation. I think it's a better way to look at inflation. But if you want to just look at core inflation is up substantially from where it was last year. It hit a low, maybe 0.6% last year, and is now up quite a bit from that, depending on which measure you look at. So more than doubled. So that's a puzzle because most people that work with core inflation were predicting that it was going to stay low or even decline further because of a large output gap. So that's a puzzle for those that want to argue that we should just look at core inflation. Now, core inflation is not is right in our target zone, so it's not really above target at this point. But it's but if we took further easing action, then it'd be reasonable to assume that would go higher as well. So that's where we are. The inflation picture is different than it was last year. That makes any kind of further easing a much tougher call.
The economy grew 1.5% from June of 2010, to June of 2011. Is that stall speed?
It's just slow growth. I don't know if I'd call it stall speed because I'm not quite sure how to define that, but it was slower than expected. I do think that this July GDP report was very important for people that watch the economy and people that work in financial markets because I think it caused many people to start to revise down their notions of potential growth for U.S. GDP. And if you move down your potential growth rate for the next 5 to 10 years, then that's a good reason to mark down corporate profits and therefore the equity prices in the U.S. So I think that's a big factor behind the recent sell-off in the stock market. That makes a lot of sense to me. I think that was a bigger factor than the debate about the debt ceiling or the European sovereign debt crisis.
Yeah, and it was funny because that debate was raging when we got that revision. We got the second quarter GDP number, and hidden in it was that first quarter GDP revision.
And plus it marked down all the growth rates going back for several years.
Yeah, I don't know if you had a chance to look at it because you've been busy with this very important conference. You've got all weekend to catch up. But a note from Merrill Lynch, sent over to me by Neil Dutta, pointed out that the corporate profits growth in the second quarter were pretty good. One of those signs that perhaps, you know, there's all the, we can focus on all the negatives for the economy right now and this worry about even a more severe slowdown, but there's still some signals that there's growth.
Yeah, I agree with that, and certainly the contacts that I have in the 8th District, bigger companies, they haven't really seen the slowdown, maybe a couple, but most of them, I can't get them to pinpoint anything about a slowdown. So I think part of what's going on is that they've got a part of their business overseas, especially Asia, but even the U.S. segment has been fairly strong, profitability is fairly strong, revenues are good. So they feel like they're in good shape. Smaller companies are more of a mixed bag, and this is something people have talked about quite a bit for the U.S. economy. So,
So the mixed bag. Let's look at the other side of the mixed bag, which is, for example, I had Martin Feldstein on my show yesterday, Harvard economist, and he notably said a couple of weeks ago, 50% chance of recession. When I interviewed Marty yesterday, he said more than 50% and rising. Do you see a growing recession risk?
I'm not sure where he's getting his numbers from. There are so-called regime switching models of that try to predict the recession. The ones I've seen are much lower probability than that. So I think the recession probably is a bit higher than it usually is, but I wouldn't say I wouldn't say anything like that. That seems extremely high to me. Now, I respect Professor Feldstein very much, so maybe he's got the right insight this time. I don't know, but the models I've looked at a bunch of them. They're not flashing that kind of a signal.
This is Jim Bullard. He's president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. I'm Kathleen Hayes. This is a special edition of Taking Stock. We're at the Jackson Lake Lodge. This is the official day one of the Kansas City Fed's 30th annual symposium. The focus this year, long-term growth. That's what the official sessions are presenting, papers and many participants and economists. And of course, a lot of discussion is, of course, on near-term growth, on the Federal Reserve, on monetary policy. And Jim has kindly agreed to keep himself away from the hiking trails or a good book or maybe even a beer over there on that lovely terrace to spend some time with us. Next time, Jim, maybe
a beer sounds good.
I was gonna say we should have some Hayes Advantage beers here. We'll try that next time. But in thinking of long-term growth and some of these big picture questions, unemployment at 9%. One of the things Ben Bernanke said in his speech today, urgently, desperately needed to, I don't know the adjective anyway, but to bring it down, kind of raises the question, to what? Do we know what the more, what would you call a natural rate of unemployment is at this point in this economy? Unemployment got as low as, what, 3.9% at our lowest point? Years before, if it got to 5%, people would have been thrilled. 9% is too high. What do you think?
I think that you really should focus on economic growth, consumption, and investment, and then labor markets will follow behind once you get those things straightened out. And I think that's the best way to look at labor markets. If you try to go labor markets first, it's kind of putting the cart before the horse. One thing I've been puzzling about is, pan-European unemployment is 9.9%. And has really never been very low in the last couple of decades. And I'd be very concerned if the U.S. was going to get into a situation like that where we just had a lot of unemployment, which sticks around for such a long time. But the thing about the European unemployment is that I've never really seen a convincing story about why the European unemployment was so high compared to, say, the U.K. and the U.S. So I don't think we really know that much about what really drives unemployment dynamics, and I think we should be careful about basing policy too closely on what unemployment is doing. Now, if you look at the last two long expansions, the one in the 1990s and the or earlier ones too, but the one in the 1990s and the one in the 2000s, as you pointed out, in the 1990s we got all the way down to 3.8% unemployment. So what really happened in the 90s, I think, is just, it was just a very, very long expansion. And it just went on and on. And because of that, and because we avoided going into any recessions or anything, unemployment just kept coming down, 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 down. And really, the same thing happened in the 2000s. You had a pretty long expansion, and unemployment got all the way down to, I think, 4.4%. So those are great numbers. But how do you get there? You get there by having, nice, steady growth for a very long period of time. That's the way to think about it. So there's no magic bullet. You really just need to put the expansion together and get it going over a long period of time.
Randy Krosner, former Fed governor, said on the show yesterday, monetary policy can't create jobs and it can't cure cancer. In other words, there's just a limit to what it can do. But I would say, so based on what you have said so far, you might agree there's some, obviously we can't go to infinity, but you still see scope for monetary policy making a difference.
Well, I have not been one that argues that we're out of bullets, out of ammunition, can't do anything. I don't make those kind of arguments. I think the central bank can conduct a perfectly fine stabilization policy even when the policy rate is at zero. That's my position. So now there's even the best stabilization policy just has limits to what it can do. All it's doing is sort of mitigating the fluctuations in the economy a little bit from what they would otherwise be, but it's not solving all the other problems in the economy, the fiscal problems and human capital, taxation, all those things are not being solved by this. But you can run an effective stabilization policy even when the policy rate's at zero.
Can you get jobs growing, get the economy growing, and make monetary policy more effective without somehow giving the housing market the right operation, the right medicine, the right something?
It's true, and the chairman mentioned it in his speech, that the housing market has typically led the recovery. It's an interest-sensitive sector, and in the past, when you had very low interest rates, housing would come roaring back, and you'd have a lot of home sales and a lot of construction. Obviously, since this time around, since it was a housing bubble, that isn't going to happen, and so that component of the this recovery is missing compared to past recoveries, and I don't think anybody really expects that to be a leading area of growth. So that's a slow, painful process, and you're going to have to rely on other sectors in the economy to lead the recovery.
You have said recently that you thought the housing market, that drop in home prices, overshot to the downside. Do you still think that? Do you see any signs of a housing recovery anytime soon?
The housing prices have drifted down even further, but the amount that they've gone down recently is nothing compared to the amount that they came down off the peak, because they're about 30% off the peak. I think broadly speaking, they're bouncing along a bottom or drifting a little bit lower, but I do think they'll eventually firm up here and eventually turn up, but that's a long, slow process, and it does mean unloading some of the inventories that are out there and working through the foreclosures that are out there, or otherwise getting back to equilibrium in the market.
Jim, you also have said, I know you said that last time I was at the St. Louis Fed, and this was at the beginning of the year when you were looking for the economy to pick up in the second half, and you had a number of reasons why I have them listed. But as I look for that list, the one thing I want to point out is that while you look for the energy and commodity prices to come off, you thought maybe the fiscal situation would make progress, you thought we'd get away from the impact of the tsunami, the Japan disaster, yeah, et cetera. What I took from that is one of your big concerns was the European debt crisis.
Yeah.
That there was one thing that didn't look like it would necessarily improve and would come back to bite us, that was it. Well, a lot of the stock market volatility we've seen, some would even say the loss of confidence to a certain extent, has to do with that.
Yeah. Earlier in the year, I was saying that there were four things that could turn into global macroeconomic shock. The first one was Japan and the disaster there. That did not turn into a global macro shock. The second one was energy prices. Those have moderated, so that did not turn into a global macro shock. The U.S. fiscal situation, which even then you could see was going to heat up, the debate was going to heat up. But still, at the end, I don't think it was a global macro shock. It was more or less resolved the way people predicted. They predicted that Congress would wait till the last minute. They would push up against a deadline. They'd reach a deal, which is what happened at the end. But I also listed the European sovereign debt crisis, and that one is still lingering and could still blow up on us. So that's the one that hasn't really gone away, unfortunately. As the chairman said today, I do think that the European leaders are very much want to keep the euro together, want to keep the European project together, and I think they will do that, but they're going to do it in their own way, which is going to be a slow way where they only take one step at a time, and at each juncture they have to get political approval, and that's going to be a long, drawn-out process. So I just don't think we should... Given that process, we should not expect a silver bullet here, and we should not expect that crisis to go away anytime soon.
Final question on the budget. And again, this isn't your purview. You conduct monetary policy along with your colleagues on the Federal Market Committee. But as an economist, as a macroeconomist looking at this, what is the correct solution? What, in its basic form, what would the best deficit solution look like to you?
Well, I'm not sure I can outline a solution to the for the national budget, but I will say we did see a paper here by Steve Schicchetti and colleagues. He's from the BIS, and those estimates suggested that countries that have debt to GDP ratios greater than 85% or 90% are hurting their growth rates by carrying so much debt. And what they should really do is get their levels of debt quite a bit below 85% to 90% so that they have some capacity to borrow if they need to. So I think that's the direction you need to be going in and what you need to be thinking about for the U.S. fiscal situation. We do not want to go to 150%, 200% the way Japan has. I think we want to come down to levels like 50% or 40%.
Okay. So. Well, we'll let you concentrate on monetary policy. Okay. Jim Buller, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoy talking with you, as always.
As always, a pleasure. Jim Buller, President of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. This is Kathleen Hayes. I'm at the Jackson Lake Lodge. I'm heading out. But before I do, I'm turning it back over to Courtney Donahoe. She's back in our New York studio, the co-anchor of Taking Stock. And Courtney, get home safe and avoid that hurricane.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keene and listen to the Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM satellite radio channel 113. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.